Talk given Sunday, 1st May, 1977. Child of the immortal light, have you treasured each tear like a pearl in your heart? The voice of one that loves calls incessantly, "Come home, beloved, come home by the road of virtue. There is no other way. Let the natural springs of your heart move your feet, unbleeding, on the road of many names, love and beauty and wisdom and peace and joy. As you walk, you will see the goodness of God fill all the world. Such is the way of virtue." Now let us look into it in a little detail. Child of the immortal light, because that is just what we are, children of the immortal light. But what can be the meaning of a phrase like immortal light? What word, in fact, can we ever use for that creative power because of which the entire cosmos has come into being, including ourselves? We may use God, we may use transcendence, we may say nature, we may say anything we like. We may use a very modern word, energy, because that word energy is appropriate to this particular period in which we live, this particular century, this day and age. And this energy is of necessity, as far as any human being can see, immortal. Because it doesn't begin, it doesn't proceed, it doesn't die. It is beyond, it transcends the sphere of mortality. For the very simple reason that this energy, this creative power, the totality, remains the totality whatsoever happens. But light is a useful word in this particular context, because when one has realized virtue in the true sense of the word virtue, one's whole being is enlightened in consequence. So it has a special reference to us. I am suggesting these things in order to indicate how we may understand passages of this type throughout the book, or throughout any scripture particularly. Child of the immortal light, have you treasured each tear like a pearl in your heart? There is no need to expound the fact that all the world has been, is, and will continue to be in tears time and again, as long as the completion of the task for each individual is not accomplished. There is sorrow, the sorrow of our own making, through our ignorance, through our inborn incapacity at the beginning of our lives, through our ill understood, drives and urges, our whims and appetites and fancies, all of which make us chase pleasure, almost invariably at the cost of truth, of reality, and of health. It is our indiscriminate pursuit of pleasure, both consciously and unconsciously, which brings us to the end of our life, immature in mind, devoid of vision, devoid of understanding of the significance and purpose of our existence here, and all the way from birth to death, we have known frustration, disappointment, sorrow, illness, fear, anxiety, and so forth. So the ocean of tears is never empty as far as the race of man is concerned. But treasure each tear like a pearl, because it is those very tears, that is to say, what they represent in terms of actual experience and our actual state of being, those very tears contain that essence of reality and truth which it is our personal responsibility to discover. How and why am I in tears? And remember that if it is the religious life with which we are concerned, if it is true human fulfillment with which we are concerned, then we must not seek the origin of those tears and the cause of those tears in order to get rid of them and successfully pursue our desire. This is the supreme difficulty. Man wants to get rid of pain and sorrow. But merely to get rid of pain and sorrow, more often than not, sows the seeds of greater pain and greater sorrow. Because our pain and sorrow comes fundamentally through our self-orientation, our selfness, which cuts us off from what we commonly call the not-self. So, if we want to get rid of our tears in order to please the self, to do what we like, to gain what we desire, then that ocean of tears will never pass away. There'll be more tears and futile tears. But take those tears, understand them fully, and understand them in relationship to totality, in relationship to the purpose of our existence here in this world. Discover it. Discover it, and don't fix it as an idea, a concept, because every fixation will lead to more tears, will lead to more illness, neurosis, and so forth. Psychosis. See? But treasure each tear in the right way. And in that, inner vision will open up. And we begin to see then in what respect, in what way, and what is the meaning of each one of us being a child of the immortal light. And if we recognize that, and grow to our full and true manhood, then we ourselves are that light, that life. That is why the great teachers all declared, you'll find it in the Gita said by Sri Krishna, you know what Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, the life, and so forth. All the great teachers have affirmed that. And they have affirmed it not in the limited sense of I, Jesus, the son of Joseph and Mary, or Krishna, the son of my parents, am the way, the life, and so on. But this I, referred to by the great teachers, is not only themselves, the organism named by the name of that teacher, but it is the total I, the one and only real I, the immortal I, which is the totality recognizing its own complete selfhood as such. And when that says I, then there is no other I beside it. Everything, you and I, when we say I, imply therefore you, the other, or that, the other. There's no such implication in the supreme transcendental truth. So, child of the immortal light, have you treasured each tear like a pearl in your heart? The voice of one that loves calls incessantly. Who is this one that loves? What is this one that loves? It is this immortal light. It is what we name God or Brahman or Ahura Mazda or Allah or any name you like to give. It is the totality. It is the unborn, the unmade, the unbecome, that which never dies, which is stainless and sorrowless, which is the totality. It is that divinity embodied in us, which is the one that loves. But loves how? Undesirously, transcendentally, hence loves with an infinite patience, with no question of reward or punishment to be delivered to me, the individual, for good doing or evil doing. Now you see how that love heals. Poets have said, people have believed, oh, love heals everything. How? Because it accepts and understands in totality. It knows no such thing as rejection. It rejects nothing whatsoever. It has no need to reject. It doesn't strive to pick and choose, exercise any preferential choice one way or the other. It is that which is embodied in us that loves and calls incessantly. Calls not through any deliberate action of calling, but by virtue of the fact that it is there. The sun shines if there are no clouds, and you go out in the sun, it is impossible for you not to receive the light and heat of the sun. There it is. The sun doesn't deliberately say, I'll give light and heat to all these dear people. It doesn't say that. It just shines. It just radiates heat, life, warmth, comfort. And also, remember, terrible light, terrible heat, and a most uncomfortable comfort often. This is one of the things about the sun and its symbolism which we must all understand. So it is in that way that this one which is embodied within us calls. It is an influence, a silent, perpetual influence which is wholly non-compulsive. This is an important point to bear in mind. It is non-compulsive because one of the special purposes of our existence, now we are in the limited context of mankind, and this is a limited context, not the total context, not the infinite. One of the special purposes to be fulfilled through mankind is to bring to fruition the power of right choice. Now, we must understand clearly what is meant by right choice. We, as we are, constantly exercise preferential choice. But who is the one that prefers the separate I? The separate self. I prefer this, do that. And in that there is a rejection of that. But when there is no preferential choice, and the sense of I, which is growing in the religion, is truly at one with the total I, it doesn't exercise any preferential choice, but right choice, meaning that it deliberately, because it has seen the truth, it deliberately directs its energies towards the fulfillment of the purpose of existence, of the existence of mankind. And this right choice means that we live in tune with this immortal light that calls incessantly. You see the extraordinary implications and the direct significances of statements like this. Don't treat them as, oh, a charming expression or nice poetry or some such thing, and then put it back on the shelf, because then there'll be more tears to come. And this is quite a serious matter. Once one gives oneself or begins to respond to the call of the transcendent, then woe unto the person who falls away from it. He can't. The hound of heaven, who is within one's own being, holds you in a tight grip. He bites deeply into you and brings you back to the path again and again. One's own conscience becomes sharper, more conscious, clearer and clearer, and is always at work within one's being. This is how we receive, we bring about the painful results of our ill-doing. We are the decreers of, to use the common words, reward and punishment to ourselves. There is no God, or as it is picturesquely put in India, for instance, the great lords of karma who dispense, dole out the results the karmic results of our actions to each individual person. That's obviously nonsensical. It is at least obvious to me. It's a belief which is held, and it's a misrepresentation of what actually happens in the psyche of man and in the life of man. But you can't dole out like that for the very simple reason that everything is perpetually changing. If there were lords of karma doling out, in the very act of doling out everything is changing, then what are they doling? And how can they measure? If the weights in your scales are continuously changing, and if that which you have put on the other scale of the balance is also a continuously changing thing, you see, how are you going to measure and dole out precisely? Utterly nonsensical. You see, there is a much truer and a profounder way of understanding it all. Simplest of all, regard it as that which happens within your own being in relationship to the continuously changing environment. And the pain and the calm or whatever it is that you go through is the immediate consequence. Karma functions immediately. It is the immediate consequence, the resultant of the sum total of forces in operation. And they are never changeless. They are perpetually changing. Come home by the road of virtue. There is no other way. Now you'll notice that in this book certain words like virtue are sometimes printed in small capitals and sometimes in the ordinary way, what the printer calls lower case. You see, when it is printed in capitals, it stands for the transcendental meaning of virtue. Our ordinary meaning of virtue is that which is the opposite of vice. But we know virtue, vice in that sense, in the dualistic sense, because our psyche functions ambivalently, either or, making division. God knows no such division. Brahman knows no such division. The unborn, the unbecome, the unmade knows no such division. It is the totality. It is the absolute all the time. It rejects nothing, remember. I repeat that. It rejects nothing whatsoever. You see? So, virtue, in the transcendental sense, is not the opposite of vice. It is something you and I cannot express in either concept or word. There is no language in the world whatsoever which can use words with specific meaning to signify the transcendent reality. They can only suggest the transcendent reality. The words which come closest to suggesting transcendent reality with least misrepresentation are the words which have no specific meaning whatsoever. What is the meaning of the word God? Brahman, Godhead, Atma. What is the meaning of the infinite, the immeasurable, the transcendent? There are no sounds we can make which can signify specifically what all this is. But these words, like Brahman and the infinite, the supreme, the absolute, they're all words which you cannot measure, which lie completely outside the context of our ordinary everyday functioning in terms of senses and brain and the discursive mind and the logical intellect. See? So when we talk of God's love or the wisdom of the Buddha, the Buddha mind or something like that, when we use terms like that, we are using terms to suggest transcendence. But the brain can never form a meaning and say, this is the Buddha mind. It isn't. The Buddha himself said that those who talk about the deep things, and of course I plead guilty there, whatsoever they say about it, it is not so. And yet the Buddha himself talked about the deep things occasionally. Not too often, occasionally. He talked about the deep things. Why do we talk about the deep things? Why do we use these sounds, these symbolical sounds? Just to convey some influence, some energy, which may call forth, which may evoke the right response from the listener, if he is listening rightly. And that's all one can do. You know the good old English saying, you may take a horse to the trough, to the water, but you can't make him drink. If he drinks, all well and good, but you can't make him drink. Similarly with these words. That is why I say again and again, the transcendent is non-compulsive, but it is a permanent influence. When the sun shines, it doesn't shout out to you, hey, Jim, come out into my sunshine. It doesn't. Either you come out into the sunshine or you don't. That's your responsibility. It's like that. So, come home by the road of virtue. What is the meaning of this word virtue? The real meaning. Its real meaning is strength, power, creative power. This is virtue. The Latin word vir means a man. And virtus is the strength of the man. Now, we are inclined to think immediately in terms of his muscular strength, his physical strength. Or we talk of the strength of his character. Something very much deeper than those. Those are not so important. In fact, they have hardly any importance. It is the strength of this embodied transcendence within each one of us. How often the great saints and the great spiritual teachers of the world were people whose bodies were frail, who had no strength of character at all, according to our particular pictures of strength of character. Someone who is adamant, who is self-assertive, who will bear anything and everything against opposing forces or people who are against him or try to destroy him. They call that, oh, what a strong character. Yes, in that context, the words apply. But this is a different context. This is the context of religion. Strength, therefore. the strength of mind, the transcendent mind. Man, the word man comes from man, manyate. Unfortunately translated as to think. Its supreme meaning is the creative power which in activity brings into being cosmos. That's why in Genesis, and God said, they should have, it would have been better if they had written, and God minded, let there be light, and there was light. Creation, something quite different. So that is the meaning of virtue. And we have this within us, embodied in us. Come home by the road of virtue. Let the natural springs of your heart move your feet unbleeding on the road of many names. Love, beauty, wisdom, peace, joy. The natural springs of your heart. Recall childhood. How, if truth were presented to us, or we came upon it, not seeking it, naturally, spontaneously, in the real joy of life, how our whole being responded to it. Do you remember that? In the days of our childhood, as very small children, magical moments whose magic for us was completely inexplicable, and what is more, we never sought the meaning. We never sought the explanation of that magic, and that is the charm of being as a little child. And we have to get that charm back again in our adulthood. Of such is the kingdom of heaven. So now, that response in our childhood was the activity of the natural springs of our hearts. Let the natural springs of your heart move your feet. And I have said unbleeding. You know how all the great mystics and all the great religia throughout the world's history have talked of the way being difficult, straight and narrow, perfectly true. They have talked of the flints and sharp thorns and so on, which prick and one moves along the road with bleeding feet. But that is because we in our adulthood, turning to religion and the religious life, have had those natural springs of our heart somewhat dried up. But if those natural springs of the heart function, then it is a case of treading the path, living the holy life, treading it in an upper air, so to say, where there are no stones and no flints and no thorns to prick. It is a life of extraordinary peace and joy. There is no personal satisfaction whatsoever involved in it. It is the joy of the eternal itself listening to its own silence and finding its expression in our own life as religious. Therefore, one's feet are unbleeding, and the unbleeding feet are usually more efficient in treading the path which is the holy life than the bleeding feet. As you walk, you will see the goodness of God fill all the world. One may ask, how dare you talk about seeing the goodness of God fill all the world? Look at the world today. Haven't you got eyes to see? Where is the goodness? We see the life of man filled with horror, with murder, with lechery, with evil, with utter bestiality. Everywhere in the world, a deliberate destruction of order and peace and harmony and so forth. How dare you talk about the goodness of God filling the world? Yes, this is how it is, that the world in its external shape and form is like this. But if one has become virtue embodied, this omnipotence of divinity come to full flower in oneself, this utter purification of the whole psyche, so that the transparent light of the eternal shines freely through and in one's own being, then the goodness of God is completely manifest in that person, himself. And in that state, although he sees the fact as the fact, and in terms of worldly criteria the fact is described as evil, he knows that the process of change will ultimately transform all this into something unpredictable, something very rich, something very strange. You know the word phoenix. Out of the ashes arises the new creation. Unbelievable. But yet out of those very ashes will arise the new creation. Have you not seen, for example, how plants began to shoot up out of those terrible rubble heaps of solid concrete in the city of London after the bombing? Within about 2 years, they began to shoot up. I have seen that myself. It was an extraordinary experience. This power of life, this something which is transcendent, is so powerful, so wonderful, that despite all man's devilish destructiveness, within a short time, out of the ashes, out of solid rock, came lovely plants. And if that, if there is the realization that each one of us is the child of the immortal light, the goodness of God is present within one. And in the light of that goodness, one sees the goodness of God fill all the world. Such is the way of virtue. If we could understand this, we could understand why all the great religious teachers spent most of their energy in presenting the virtuous life and never bothered themselves with any philosophical systems.